Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. The vaccine rollout, a debate over Wisconsin's wolf hunt, redistricting, Afghanistan, immigration. What did it all mean? And how will history look back on 2021? The year brought so many challenges, there were also plenty of things to celebrate over the past 12 months. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Today it's time for our annual Year in Review. It's a look back at the many programs that entertained, informed, and intrigued listeners most from January through December. We'll hear several musical performances and clips from some of our favorite and most impactful programs of 2021. Back in January, the widespread introduction of life-saving vaccines came with optimism that the pandemic would soon be over, but at the same time sparked many questions. Dr. Jonathan Tempte from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health joined us for a discussion on the rollout. So, Dr. Tempte, this vaccine was developed in record time. We know there was a lot of talk about this, that we expected it was going to take a lot longer. How did it happen that this one was pushed through so quickly?
Well, there were a couple things to keep in mind. First of all, a great deal of the technology behind these vaccines have been under development for upwards toward 10 years. So it wasn't anything that was brand new off the shelf, but some of the companies, particularly BioNTech, a German company, had been working on the spike protein previously. So that's kind of the first component. Number two is very, very early on in this pandemic. So going all the way back to more than a year ago now, the initial viruses were completely sequenced. So we understood the genetic blueprint to these viruses. And those virus blueprints were shared by the Chinese across the world. So that allowed people to have the exact blueprint for this protein, the spike protein that we use to make vaccines. On top of that, there was a great deal of investment of public funds from NIH and through Operation Warp Speed to take some of the risk away from the companies developing these. So they had the green light to really push forward. And so in very, very quick time, we had prototype vaccines. We were able to do the initial testing in May, June, and July, and actually get started with clinical trials with large scale. And then finally, what really benefited the large scale clinical trials was we had a huge amount of coronavirus infections out there. And whenever you're doing a vaccine trial, you're dependent on people who are in both the vaccine arm and the placebo arm to come into contact with the pathogen or the germ out there and become infected. And by looking at that differential between those vaccinated and those not vaccinated, we can calculate how well that vaccine works. And the good news for the vaccines and the bad news for the rest of us is this past fall we had a huge outbreak across the United States, but this allowed the clinical trials to proceed very, very quickly. And hence we had approvals of vaccines, our first two in December of 2020.
That was Dr. Jonathan Tempte, his thoughts on the vaccine rollout. In February, we invited Portage County District Attorney Louis Malepsky and Chris Teagarden of the Wisconsin Cannabis Association to discuss the potential implications marijuana legalization or decriminalization would have on communities in our area. Some of what they said was surprising. Louis, the backlog for prosecutors and public defenders in North Central Wisconsin has been well documented. We have talked about it on Route 51 before. There are defendants throughout North Central Wisconsin who have been waiting for 1, 2, sometimes 3 years for their cases to conclude. We know that nearly 600,000 Americans are arrested for marijuana possession every year nationwide. Would taking marijuana cases off your plate as a prosecutor have a significant impact on the court system, from prosecutors to public defenders?
Well, according to Representative Sortwell and Senator Bernier, between 2009 and 2018, there was 161,016 arrests made in Wisconsin for simple possession, and there were 19,190 arrests for possession with intent to deliver. In Portage County, we have since 1997 had 2,541 charges referred for prosecution. Currently we have 58 active charges in our office, and those are in the deferred prosecution program. There's a few that are in this traditional court setting. And I want to just give you a little perspective. So 2,541 charges, if we say those were all entered in the system, that would cost the state taxpayers $137,849.25, because each prosecutor has 1,277 hours per year to prosecute a case. I'm paying that prosecutor about $52,000 a year. So that comes out to 5,513 hours to prosecute 2,541 simple misdemeanors. If it's a felony level, then that hours goes up because there's prelims. So yes, you know, not to dive too much into the weeds as people accuse me of, but yes, there is a cost to the taxpayer. And that's why this is a very, very important topic, because what is the social cost to prosecute the case? We've heard from the medical perspective, because there's absolutely a medical perspective here. And what is the cost-benefit analysis? And that's why I'm very interested in this topic, because we've taken the position that we're going to not prosecute people criminally if they go into a diversion program. And what we do is we make sure that they don't have long major effects. If they don't, they get cut out of our program right away. Because the longer you keep someone in the criminal justice system, the more likely they will have more criminal tendencies. They actually become better criminals. We don't want that.
That was Portage County District Attorney Louis Malepsky, part of a conversation on marijuana legalization. Later in February, we learned about Iron Bull, which promotes outdoor extreme adventure contests in Wausau. We also hosted a discussion on the Mayor's Guaranteed Income Program, which gives a monthly $500 stipend to a handful of residents, no strings attached. Wausau Mayor Katie Rosenberg and University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point Professor Jason Davis spoke with us about the pros and cons. To be fair, there is some significant criticism of these kinds of programs. Some people say it's a handout, it's not a hand up, and that doesn't fit with America's economic model. Some even consider this a form of socialism. So, Jason, what do you think about that? What do you think about that criticism? Is it valid?
Yeah, there's some validity to that. I mean, it's natural that we all treat money differently when it's found, rather than being earned. You know, if I work a bunch of overtime and my take-home pay goes up by $100, I'm going to be very careful about how I spend that $100. If I find a $100 bill on the sidewalk, I'm going to go buy something stupid. And I think that's just kind of a natural response that, you know, when we earn things, we do tend to be more focused on how we spend it. But if we're targeting this toward families that are already struggling to meet basic needs, I think that's probably less of an issue.
Katie, how do you respond when somebody says, hey, this sounds like a socialism idea. This is a socialist program. What do you say to that?
I mean, it wouldn't be the first time somebody called me a socialist, and at least this program kind of has, you know, that vibe. But, you know, for me, this is about the research. It's about getting better economic policy. It's about just being better leaders. So I, you know, if that's how people want to approach it, that's fine. I will say that across the spectrum of political beliefs, I've heard from folks who are interested in supporting this kind or being involved in it even. So it's not just a lopsided political view.
That was a discussion on the Mayor's Guaranteed Income Program, which launched in 2021, and it's something we'll be following up on in the coming year. In March, we hosted our legislative quarterly roundup with Republican State Representative Calvin Callahan from Tomahawk and Democratic State Representative Katrina Shankland of Stevens Point. Here, both representatives shared their thoughts on juvenile justice issues close to home. One thing the governor made clear in his budget address is his position on juvenile justice. And this has been an issue that has been debated over and over. Wisconsin continues to treat some underage defendants as adults in the criminal justice system, and this varies from state to state. And during the address, the governor said he would like to see all juveniles shifted back to the juvenile system, except, of course, a few specific instances. Katrina, do you see any legislative movement in that direction at this time?
I do. I have been on that bill as long as I've been in the legislature, and it's been bipartisan. And I know that over time, the number of co-sponsors has grown, And that, you know, the one concern that the counties expressed that we need to fund it then has been addressed. And so I don't see any reason why we shouldn't do it. I think we're one of just a handful of states that continues to try 17-year-olds as adults. We also know, you know, the brain science of the matter. We know that people's brains aren't really fully, formed probably isn't the right word, but fully addressed in terms of its growth until the age of 25. And so there isn't really any criminal justice reason why we should try all 17-year-olds as adults. The bill that has been bipartisan in the past does make a few exceptions, and it has had strong bipartisan support. So I think it's a smart move for the governor to put it in the budget. It opens up the process for us to debate it, especially given the legislative conversation that we've had surrounding Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. I think this is something we need to look at. And let me point out this. Criminal justice reform has had, across the nation, strong bipartisan support. You've seen groups that are very conservative come together with liberal and progressive groups on these issues. You've come together with faith-based groups as well, and taxpayer alliances. And so we need to find a better way forward, and I appreciate that the governor is leading on this.
And those exceptions are pretty stark, like homicide, those the most serious crimes, is that correct?
Yes,
okay.
Correct. It's certain felonies, yes.
Okay. And Calvin, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake juvenile prisons are right in your backyard. I mean, that's right there. So yes. This issue must be especially relevant for you, but the governor is calling for the closure of those prisons, replacing them with a new network of state and county juvenile treatment centers. What are you hearing from constituents in your district about this?
Yeah, well, let me first start off by saying that I also, as Representative Shanklin said before, huge supporter of criminal justice reform. But with Lincoln Hills, we've heard a lot of constituents that are definitely very concerned about the facility, how staff deal with these individuals at the facility. But what it comes down to is, you know, the counties that we were looking at for the smaller facilities, I guess in the past when I wasn't there, had turned down taking over these smaller facilities. Ultimately, what people here in the district are telling me is they want the jobs. The jobs are important to the people here in the area. The facility is important to the people in the area. Maybe not in the capacity it's serving now, but I'm definitely supportive of criminal justice reform, like you talked about earlier, and making sure that facility stays in the area.
That was a portion of just one of our legislative roundups held out throughout the year. Though the pandemic limited our ability to connect in person with musicians, we were lucky enough to feature several bluegrass artists in an unforgettable program last year. Here is a portion of one of those performances. Art Stevenson and Dale Reichert of Highwater and Steph and Jimmers Lee of Sloppy Joe with the song Sawmill Town on Route 51. Back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert guiding you through our annual Year in Review, a look back at the conversations that made 2021 a year to remember. As the partisan battle over Wisconsin's redistricting process heated up, we took a deep dive into the issue with political scientist Eric Giordano of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Here, Eric explained, in simple terms, what gerrymandering actually is. Wisconsin sometimes referred to as the most gerrymandered state in the country. Can you explain gerrymandering in layman's terms? What is it exactly?
Right. Well, thank you. I think Maryland might, folks in Maryland might disagree that I think they sometimes think they're the most gerrymandered, but whether Wisconsin or Maryland, gerrymandering really is the act of politicians manipulating and redrawing the legislative district lines. And of course, with a purpose, right? To help their party, to hurt the other party, you know, to get as much representation for their party as they can. And, you know, this has been an historical phenomenon in American politics, really, you know, since the origins of the country and our sort of immediate split into sort of two political factions. So Elbridge Gerry is whom this idea is named after because of the way that some districts were drawn in the state of Massachusetts. And there's a famous picture that maybe many of your viewers remember of this kind of dragon-like shape that kind of spans across the western part and northern part of Massachusetts. So ever since then, you know, politicians have been trying to manipulate those lines. And for better or worse, the courts in our country at the highest level have basically said, look, we do think there are some reasons why we have to protect certain voters, like we want to, you know, because of issues of slavery and Jim Crow and discrimination against particularly African-American voters, but other voters as well. You know, we are going to limit some of how, you know, politicians are able to manipulate districts. But in terms of just political partisanship, the courts have seemed to sort of take a back seat and say, you know, we can't really change that. You know, that's part of the nature of our system. And even if we could, what would we do to make it fair? And so, you know, gerrymandering, you know, is still very, it rules the day, as you pointed out here in Wisconsin still.
That was Eric Giordano of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. In our next program, we discussed the creative economy and tourism in central Wisconsin. Then we welcomed artists Karen Ann Hoffman of the Oneida Nation and Wayne Ballier of the Lac des Flambeaux Ojibwe, who were each awarded National Heritage Fellowships for their contributions to traditional arts in the United States and their efforts to teach their craft to the next generation of traditional artists. Here's a portion of that program. How were you drawn to raise beadwork as an artistic calling? What led you to this particular type of craft?
I'm fond of saying that I didn't choose raised beadwork, that raised beadwork chose me. I had no choice in the matter. It is, to me, the perfect vehicle at this time to express that unbroken link between the past, present, and the future. When I pick up a needle and thread and I'm working with those beads and that velvet, I'm at an intersection of time where the past, the present, and the future exist all at once in that self-same stitch. There is no linear description of time like you might see on a timeline in a geography book. What there is a community of Haudenosaunee, all those who have ever existed, all of us who currently exist, and all those faces we have yet to see, all exist in that same stitch at that same time. I didn't choose that magic. That magic allowed me into its realm.
That was Karen Ann Hoffman talking about the inspiration behind her work. In April, Raul Castro said he would step down as the head of Cuba's Communist Party, leaving Cuban Americans wondering if change would finally come to their native home. Dr. Fernando Fritz Riveron, a retired Wausau heart surgeon, joined us on Route 51 to share the story of his family's escape from Cuba in the 1960s. This is part of his story.
So leaving it was an interesting phenomenon because, you know, you never knew whether you'd see your family again. You know, Cuba became sort of an island prison for many years where people could not get in or out. And the way that they did it actually was, you know, as you were going to leave, you went to the airport and there was a glass enclosure. I mean, it was like a glass wall, and the people leaving would go on the other side and be processed by the military. So they'd go through all your suitcases, and you know. So my mom had, took her wedding ring and sewed it into the strap of her bra. But they went through things, and they, you know, reportedly, although I don't remember this, but reportedly they were kind of malicious. They would take, you know, kids' dolls and rip their heads off, and you know, take pictures, and you know, so what do you, you know, what do you take when you're leaving your world forever, you know?
Right.
So I do remember the military and those green outfits going through our stuff. And then you're in this glass enclosure when you're being processed, where you can see your family across the glass, you know, very emotional, of course, you may never see each other again. People believe, you know, immigrants believe that it was done on purpose, you know, to increase the pain of leaving, you know, that you'd see the separation, you'd actually visualize it for hours as you're being processed, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, they called the people that left, they called them gusanos, which means worms. So really? for years, we who left here to the United States were called gusanos. So they treated, you know, you were anti-revolutionary, you didn't believe in their ideology, and because of that, we were treated as, you know, the lowest of the low, that like they could do anything to your family that left behind. And so, you know, typically they would be persecuted to some extent, lose jobs, lose ability to advance in their jobs, etc.
The enormous emotional toll that must have taken on your family. Tell me what happened when you boarded the plane. Was it your first time on a plane? What was it like?
So I was just at a museum, by the way, in Miami. It's the Museum of the Cuban Diaspora, they call it. And they had a number of exhibits, and one of them showed this glass enclosure. I mean, so it's, that was like such a poignant thing for people. But then on the other side, it showed the Pan Am airplane, you know, one of these prop planes. And so I remember that very, very vividly. Remember getting on the plane, first time ever, you know, you walk down the aisle of this airplane. Our family sat across from each other. You know, there were five of us, three kids and my parents. And I also remember, you know, this is one of those memories that is this a real memory or... But I remember the plane stopping on the tarmac, and then soldier getting on with one of those little short submachine guns and walking up and down the aisle, staring at everybody, like looking for someone. I think it was mostly to intimidate people who might be doing like what my dad was doing. Finally, it took off, you know, and, you know, as a kid, you know, the first time on a plane, you know, it's exhilarating. But, you know, you could sense that our parents were extremely upset. And so word got around the airplane that there was a doctor on board, and everybody started clapping.
Just knowing that he had gotten out, that he was successful.
Managed to get out, right, with his family.
Wow. That was Dr. Fernando Fritz Riveron, who fled Cuba as a child and eventually settled in Wausau. In May, we celebrated Wisconsin's rich baseball tradition. Extra Innings featured guests from the Twin Ports to Wausau, La Crosse, Eau Claire, and beyond. Ezra Wall from Newsmakers and La Crosse co-hosted the program. In Duluth, what do Duluth fans love most about the games? What do you want them to come away with?
We want them to come away with the fact that they need to come back. For a lot of our fans, this is their summer families. You know, they only see these people that they sit around during the baseball season, and they make good friends, you know, they swap stories half the time. I don't even know, as Kayla said too, if they're even watching the game. You know, they're there because this is what we do, you know, in the summer. And so for us as well, whether it's somebody's having a birthday party and a whole section of people get a free piece of birthday cake or what have you, or giving away roses to some lucky person sitting in the stands. You know, these are the sorts of things that just seem to make everybody feel like they're part, you know, part of a larger family. It's all of that that makes people say, you know what, this was fun. I'm coming back.
That was Mike Rosenzweig from the Duluth Huskies talking about the magic of Northwoods League Community Baseball and its role in our communities. Next, we turned our attention to gardening before hosting a serious discussion on new ways that corrections officials are approaching juvenile justice through cognitive therapy. And in honor of Memorial Day, we were joined by Annette Langloy Grunseth, a Wisconsin poet who released a book that chronicles the Vietnam War experience through the eyes of her brother, a Wausau Army sergeant who served and later died as a result of his exposure to Agent Orange. Here's a portion of that program.
Annette, take me back in time. The day your brother's draft number was chosen. Tell me what happened.
Oh, gosh. He was graduating from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in June of 1967. He was just coming off of a year of lots of campus protest at UW-Madison. The Dow Chemical protest, anti-war protests were at their peak. Tet had just happened in Vietnam, where the major invasion occurred of South Vietnamese cities and attacks against U.S. soldiers. And my brother was classified 1A upon graduation, June 1967. And he went off in the summer on a canoe trip, and he canoed across Canada with his best friend. And we wondered, is he going to come home? And he did. His sense of duty and citizenship won out. He went off to basic training in the fall of 67, and he was prepared, basic training and then advanced infantry training, and everybody was being prepared for Vietnam. He knew that. And I was coming up on the spring of 68. I was graduating from high school. We had a turbulent summer politically in the news as well as at home. My grandmother died. I graduated from high school. Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. had just been assassinated, and off he goes to Vietnam in July. And he arrives, his draft number was a real low number, so he didn't really have much choice. He went, and he arrives in Vietnam the day before his 23rd birthday.
A lot going on, a lot to process.
It was. My mother was really kind of hysterical because her brother had been in World War II and was missing in action and never came home. So the day we said goodbye to my brother, I think my mother cried for a week because she thought, I'm not going to see him again. And that's what we kind of all thought.
When those letters started coming home, when Peter started to write about his experiences, what did it mean to you and your family to receive those letters? In that time, in that moment?
Oh, it was like Christmas when a letter arrived in the mailbox, because we knew he was still alive and he was a very good writer, being a journalism major. And he started writing these really good letters that actually were telling stories that were a little more raw and different than what we were getting in the national news.
And some of those letters were published in the local newspaper in Wausau. How did that come about?
Well, my father, at the time, that was the Wausau Record Herald, and Frank Plano was the editor, and my dad knew him. He was a friend, and he said, hey, I got these letters. And Frank looked at them, and he said, oh, my goodness. He said, would you mind if we put them in the newspaper? He said, I'm taking a big risk here because they are different reports than some of the things we're hearing in the news. Would you mind? So they put a letter in the paper. And my brother at the time didn't know they were going in the paper, but very shortly was told that from my parents. So then he was writing, I think, knowing they were going to be in the paper. In fact, one of his letters, he talked about what happened as a result of a bombing halt where they just got ambushed and got their butts kicked. And he said, that's what's happening. Whatever is happening at home with the talks, it's not working for us in Vietnam. And then he wrote as a PS in the letter, I think this one should go in the paper so people understand what's really happening.
That was Annette Langloy Grunseth, a program that honored our fallen heroes ahead of Memorial Day weekend. In June, we had some lighter topics for discussion, talking about local food and farmers markets. We took a tour of the wineries of north central Wisconsin and helped listeners escape to the great outdoors with Camping 101. In July, we learned all about the best summer festivals in Wisconsin before turning our attention to trout and fly fishing and hosted the second of our legislative roundups for the year. And in August, we featured an introduction to the cosmos before venturing into Wisconsin supper clubs. Holly DeRuyter, producer of PBS Wisconsin's Old Fashioned, the story of Wisconsin supper clubs, spoke here about what makes a supper club. Well, a friend of mine moved here not long ago from Georgia, and she was mystified when we invited her to a supper club. And I found it almost impossible to define to her exactly what it is. And it's probably the hardest question to answer. Holly, what makes a supper club a supper club?
That is such a good question. And that is the question I found myself, what I asked myself when I started working on my project about supper clubs. Me and another friend were living in Chicago at the time. She was also from Chicago, or also from Wisconsin. And we were trying to figure that out. Like, what makes a supper club a supper club? And a big thing we talked about is how when we walked into a supper club, you could just feel it. You felt welcomed. It felt like you were walking into someone's home, which sounds very strange, but that's the feeling. You know, it's a place to gather. The other thing that, as I did more thinking and research, is you have to have, you know, a dining area and a bar area. And sometimes those can be completely separate spaces, or sometimes they can kind of commingle. I'm thinking of Shady Sue's up in Rhinelander. You got the bar right there, and it's really tight spaces, but then you got the dining tables around it. So it's really a place where people feel welcome. You see the owner when you walk in the door. They might know you by name if you're a regular. And you're going to have a good meal, homemade, a lot of local ingredients. And it's going to be a night of socializing, even if you're not there with your own friends. So that's a really quick summary of what I look for in a good supper club.
That was part of our delightful discussion on supper clubs, a uniquely Wisconsin phenomenon. Looking back, there were certainly a lot of serious topics we brought forward with the help of dozens of guests in 2021, but some of our favorite moments of the year were those that touched our heart with the gift of music. Here again is Steph and Jimmers Lee of Sloppy Joe and Art Stevenson and Dale Reichert of Highwater performing Old Joe Clark. You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. On Route 51, I'm Shireen Seward. This week, it's our annual Year in Review, a look back at the challenges, changes, and conversations that marked 2021 and made it a year to remember. As the pandemic continued and debates over vaccine mandates ramped up, we took another look at the issue, this time from a legal standpoint. Edward Fallone, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University Law School, addressed the legal implications of vaccine mandates in this discussion. One of the most heated discussions surrounding public health requirements is the balance between individual rights and public safety. Simply put, from a legal standpoint, do individual rights trump public health requirements?
No. From a legal standpoint, individual rights do not trump the good of the many or the good of the public. Certainly, as I've explained, under Supreme Court precedent, and countless cases in the last 150 years. The good of the many trumps individual rights in a whole variety of contexts. Certainly, you can't yell fire in a crowded movie theater and cause a stampede and defend yourself by saying you have a free speech right. And there's just countless examples, and public health is one. It certainly doesn't, individual rights don't trump the public good as a matter of history or tradition in our country. What we do see now is there are certain groups who are bringing legal cases, trying to establish a more libertarian view of the Constitution. They're trying to change this legal landscape. And there's nothing unusual about that. You know, groups have made concerted efforts to make our Constitution more equality-based or more gender-sensitive. You know, this is something that is part and parcel of our legal history. But we should be very conscious of what's going on. These groups want to create a body of new laws, new precedent, that take a more libertarian view and that tie the hand of government and restrict government's ability to act for the common good. I don't think it will succeed. I certainly hope it doesn't succeed. They have every right to try, but I predict they will fail.
That was Marquette Law Professor Edward Falone with his take on the legal arguments surrounding vaccine mandates. When the U.S. ended its decades-long war in Afghanistan, Fort McCoy offered temporary assistance to thousands of refugees who fled Afghanistan to avoid persecution. In September, we took an in-depth look at that process. But one of the most fascinating shows of 2021 was a look at the relationship between the Green Bay Packers and the people of Wisconsin. We celebrated the Packerland spirit with The People and Their Packers. It was a program co-hosted by Ezra Wall that included interviews with Packer fans, former players, the team historian, and more. Our favorite portion of that program, though, had to be a discussion with Packers Hall of Fame inductee Mark Tauscher, who grew up in Auburndale as a fan and then went on to play for his favorite team. Here's part of that conversation.
Scouts are looking at you. You know, draft day is approaching, and it looks like your number could get called. And then it does, and it's the hometown team who's coming knocking on your door. Talk about that.
Yeah, it was the whole process is crazy, you know, where you finish up. We're fortunate, you know, Ron Dayne wins the Heisman. We go out and we win a Rose Bowl. And from then it was just, I got to invited to the Shrine Bowl. I got invited to go over to Hawaii and play in the Hula Bowl. Then you have the combine and you go through your workouts and you don't really know what's going to happen. And, you know, for me, I just wanted to get drafted. I would obviously love the Green Bay Packers. Never thought about that. It was try to get drafted as soon as you can. And I thought I was going to be drafted by the Detroit Lions. One of their coaches called me on this back then, the draft was Saturday, Sunday. And I had a call early on Sunday morning that the fifth round I was going to get picked by the Lions. And fortunately now I was not. And the sixth round, I'm not hearing anything. I'm starting to kind of freak out a little bit. And then, luckily the Packers called me with one of their picks in the seventh round and said, we're going to select you. And at that point, I was, let's go. 2 days later, I'm driving up to minicamp where I'm seeing Farvin, Frank Winters, and, you know, a bunch of guys that I had been sitting here watching win a Super Bowl 4 or 5 years earlier. And here I am now in that locker room. It was really a crazy, you know, stretch of time for me.
I mean, in a way, talk about the ultimate fan experience, that had to be it. And yet you've got to buckle down and get a job to do. What's it like to make that transition from kind of fanboying on these guys to all of a sudden, you know, you're part of that line that's like protecting Brett Favre from, you know, what could be looming disaster?
Yeah, the reality hits you pretty quick. I think you walk in and you're kind of, you know, I remember kind of a deer in the headlights. First time I meet Frankie, and then obviously you meet Brett Favre, who's at that point, I think, a 2 or 3 time MVP. And you got a little fanboyish to you. And then all of a sudden you're out there, you're trying to block Bonnie Holiday and Santana Dotson. And, you know, the focus goes quick. Like, all right, this is awesome to better get my stuff together. This is going to be a really short trip.
You know, this is true across the country and across the world, but especially fans here in Wisconsin. And that's primarily what we're talking about today, is that fan relationship between the people and their Packers. That can get pretty intense. Those, I mean, You're talking about people who paint their houses and their cars and get tattoos and all that kind of stuff. What's it like as a player? How much of that sort of fan intensity are players aware of in that locker room?
Oh, you're aware of it. And I think, you know, being the smallest NFL town, I think you realize it's all about football, and the guys that aren't from the state of Wisconsin understand it quickly. It's the only team that is owned by the fans. So you embrace that part of it. And I think, you know, the idea that thousands of people would come to watch practice, kind of mind blowing, because, you know, you practice at Camp Randall, and that was never the case. It amazes you at first, and then it just becomes normal that, hey, people really care, because I think it really does come back to it's their football team too. And people really look at it and say they're invested literally and figuratively in the outcomes and how this team does. And I think people look at that as being pretty cool.
That was Packer Hall of Fame inductee Mark Tauscher. In October, we turned our attention to Wisconsin's wolf hunt, which is still the subject of ongoing legal action. We discussed solutions to suicide to help people struggling with thoughts of self-harm. Then we learned about the Amish people and their culture with the help of University of Wisconsin professor Mark Loudon. He's an interpreter and cultural mediator for Amish and Old Order Mennonite groups. Here's a portion of that fascinating program. Mark, what are some of the biggest misconceptions about the Amish people?
Well, I think you've touched on a couple of them. First is that they don't want anything to do with the larger society, that they reject, you know, modern society and modern technology completely. As I said before, it's about kind of like selective interactions with society, including technology. Biggest misunderstanding is obviously having to do with Amish youth gone wild. You know, most of the stories about Amish people that make their way into the popular media are the sort of dog bites man kind of stories. So things that sort of out of the ordinary, and they kind of convey a somewhat distorted picture. But I think that, you know, the Amish recognize that they're always going to be a minority in all the communities that they live in. And they realize that they're a little bit on display. And so they strive to be models, even though they're not actively engaged in mission work. They strive to be models to their neighbors in terms of, you know, living their faith in everyday lives and being good citizens and neighbors.
Do they pay taxes?
Yes, they pay all taxes because they're part of the, you know, the citizens of the United States and Canada. The only tax that they're exempt from is the Social Security withholding tax if they are self-employed. So if they're employed, say, like I mentioned before, many Amish in places like Indiana work in non-Amish enterprises like factories, then they have to have Social Security taken out of their paychecks. But they got an exception to the Social Security Act going back, I believe, in the 1950s because they, on principle, will not accept government assistance. So they don't accept what they see as handouts from the government. And therefore they say, we're never going to collect Social Security. So why should we, you know, pay into the system? Mm-hmm. But again, that exemption is only for those who are self-employed. This, you know, kind of keeping, you know, government assistance at bay was expressed most recently during the pandemic when they, like all other taxpayers, received stimulus checks. And they said, oh, what are we supposed to do with this now? Because we don't accept government assistance. And so government wasn't exactly sure. They didn't give like a return address for those checks. So it's so basically what people tried to do was mail them back. In some cases, they did send them back. Who knows what happened to the checks? Some, you know, made donations to local charities and said, well, you know, give it to the larger community, but we're not going to accept it for ourselves.
That was part of a discussion on the history and cultural heritage of Amish country in Wisconsin. In November, we turned our attention to Wisconsin's urban housing crunch before inviting local cheesemakers to discuss the processes they go through to produce the state's most beloved foodstuff. And then we spoke with a Wausau native, Ann Speckard, one of the world's top experts on international terrorism, to discuss Afghanistan's growing ISIS problem. Here's what she had to say. Ann, why do they hate us so much?
It's that they want what they don't have. And basically, they want the same things as us. They want freedom. They want to live a good life. And they're living under repressive regimes. I mean, the people in Afghanistan, it's three generations of trauma and war. And, you know, if you're living in Afghanistan, our troops weren't necessarily seen as a good thing. And if you get sucked into this mentality that ISIS is teaching, the West is at war with Islam and with Islamic people and doing unjust acts. So they're convinced that they're in a war of self-defense. And they want the same things we want, but they want to follow their religion. And if they really get sucked into ISIS, then they want a Sharia state. And but, you know, it's interesting when you start talking to people about that. If I just did this in prisons in an undisclosed location, I had an Islamic scholar with me. And when we started asking, my scholar would ask, "Brother, what ayah are you following? What hadith did you base that on?" And these people couldn't even speak Arabic. They didn't know their religion that well. And they would say, and he'd say, he recited in Arabic perfectly, beautifully, and then recite it again in its English translation and say, "Do you know the meaning of that? Do you know the context of that? Do you understand that the way you've interpreted that is completely wrong? And actually, if you were following your logic, you would talk fear of the Prophet, or you would talk fear of Caliph Umar, who the Prophet said was in paradise. So which one is right, the Prophet or you?" And these guys had kind of turned white. And but they'd also sit on the edge of their chair and really listen to him because he's an authority and they want to follow Islam. So they're just sucked into a virulent ideology and given a hope that things can change that are wrong in their lives. They are in many cases deprived of opportunities, frustrated, have real grievances, are suffering discrimination, marginalization, living under corrupt and repressive authoritarian states, and they don't like it, just as we wouldn't like it. But they think that the U.S. and Western powers are behind this, when in fact it's their own corrupt politicians that need to be changed. And they don't need to do what they're doing to change it. And it's one way to try, but it's never going to work.
That was Anne Speckard, part of a discussion on her work with ISIS defectors. Before we wrapped up the year, my colleague, Wisconsin Public Radio Central Regional Manager Rick Ryer, stepped in as guest host for a sci-fi special before hosting a program on Anishinaabe storytelling with Native American musician and storyteller Michael Laughing Fox Charette. Here's a portion of that program.
There seems to be, Michael, a really great healing power in these stories. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the stories are old. You know, they go way back, generation upon generation upon generation. When we tell these stories, they're moral stories. They're stories that have, you know, they talk about us how to live life, how to live that minimum modesty, when the good life. You know, in the beginning, there was nothing but darkness, and get your money to the Creator, he would send out his voice. And it would return without being heard. And in a vision, the Creator saw, like, all these galaxies and stars and the planets and the moons and the universe, including the Earth. And so he understood that this vision that he had seen had to be, you know, brought to life. So Gitche Moneydu, you know, he filled the Earth with oceans, lakes, rivers, all kinds of lands, mountains, plains, forests, deserts. He made four kinds of plants, you know, vegetables, trees, grasses, flowers, and he put them on the earth where they would be most beautiful and most useful. And the Creator made all the animal beings. And for the first time, animals flew, walked, and swam the earth. But last, he made the Anishinaabe, and we were created in all sizes, colors, languages, ways of living. And the Anishinaabe were given several gifts that weren't given to plants or animals. And the first one was the ability to dream, to invent ways to make our dreams come true. And also a special gift. Every one of us was given some of the mystery of the Creator. And, you know, that kind of begins our journey, you know, and like that kind of story connects us to, you know, not just to each other, but to a world community, because a lot of our creation stories reflect on other people's stories. You know, there's more things connecting us than disconnecting us.
That concludes our annual Year in Review. I'd like to thank all our guests over the past 12 months and our listeners, too. We appreciate each and every one of you. I'm Shireen Seewert. Our producer is Joy Ratch-Kramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Special music today provided by Stefan Jimmers-Lee of Sloppy Joe and Art Stevenson and Dale Reichert of Highwater, whose performances include the song you're hearing now. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, we'll host a discussion on silent sports from skiing to snowshoeing and more. And in 2 weeks, what's up with the stock market? A discussion on your money. Until then, we're heading out of town.